Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy. Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Andalusia Farm in our February 4 series. My name is Elizabeth Wiley, and I'm the executive director of the nonprofit organization that owns and manages Andalusia Farm. The farm was central to Flannery O'Connor's entire output, or entire creative output, goes without saying. We preserve this place as a memorial to Flannery and her writing, and as a place that continues to inspire authors and artists, readers, and nature lovers of all stripes from around the four corners of the globe. Each Sunday this February, we'll look at Flannery's first novel, Wiseblood, from a different perspective. I hope you all received the card, and if you haven't, you're not in our database, and we'd love if you talk to Ross, and he gets your contact info, and then you'll get our e-news and our snail mail, always good-looking bookmarks, too. This first novel will be looked at from different perspectives. Wiseblood hit the mid-century literary scene with a bit of a thud here in Milledgeville, and more than one signed copy was retrofitted with a brown paper book jacket after word got around about her grotesque approach to the themes of redemption, racism, sexism, and isolation. Flannery famously quipped that with the novel, she reached the lunatic fringe. We here at the farm can confirm the author's fan base is indeed varied and wide-ranging and includes as many points of view regarding her work. Today, we're pleased to host a writer who will offer some thoughts on Wiseblood and read from his own fiction. This will be followed by questions, discussions, and refreshments. Judson Mitchum's work has been widely published in literary journals, including Poetry, Harper's, Georgia Review, Hudson Review, and the Southern Review. He's been the recipient of an NEA Fellowship in Creative Writing, as well as a Pushcart Prize. He's the only writer to win the Townsend Prize for Fiction twice for his novels The Sweet Everlasting and Sabbath Creek. His most recent book is A Little Salvation, Poems Old and New. You'll have an opportunity to purchase those here after the presentation. Mitchum is the current Poet Laureate of Georgia, and in 2013 he was inducted into the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame. So please join me in welcoming Judson Mitchum.
Pleasure to be here. It's always kind of a surreal thing for me to come. It is, however, very strange after going over a lot of material for this talk, rereading a lot of things, to come back here. I've been here quite a few times, but this seems like a special time. The title of my talk is Unwise Blood. I am no literary critic, and I am no expert on Flannery O'Connor. But I am honored to be asked to speak about her, glad for the opportunity to look closely again at this extraordinary woman. I write fiction and poetry, and I know what she meant when she said, speaking of Faulkner, that nobody wants his mule and wagon stalled on the same track that Dixie Limited is roaring down. But for me, the more apt image would be that of a scavenger caught out by the headlights of a high, fast, rat-colored car coming right at me out on the back road. I could be a buzzard with a bad wing. The title of this talk is Unwise Blood. What could that possibly mean? I'm not sure. In preparing to make these remarks, I read just a sampling of the vast literature of commentary on Flannery O'Connor's work, and specifically on Wise Blood, and I was very quickly out of my depth, Bruce. So I turned in mild despair, which is surely a kind of pride, what isn't, to the writer's own comments. Of course, the writer does not have final say on her creation. She is not the ultimate authority on what she wrote. She does, however, have final say on what she believed herself to be doing. So, here are O'Connor's comments in a letter to John Hawkes in 1959. Hayes is saved by virtue of having wise blood. It's too wise for him ultimately to deny Christ. Wise blood has to be these people's means of grace. They have no sacraments. The religion of the South is a do-it-yourself religion, something which as a Catholic I find painful and touching and grimly comic. It's full of unconscious religious pride that lands them in all sorts of ridiculous religious predicaments. They have nothing to correct their practical heresies, and so they work them out dramatically. If this were merely comic to me, it would be no good. But I accept the same fundamental doctrines of sin and redemption and judgment that they do. That's the end of the quote. Hazel Moats' blood, she said, is too wise for him ultimately to deny Christ. My blood must be unwise then. Though denial is not the word I would use, and no, the ultimate moment has not yet arrived for me. But I am one of these people, as she puts it, without sacraments. My childhood was characterized by an intense focus on that do-it-yourself religion. A description I do not disagree with, given the endless hours of anguish I spent in church pews and elsewhere trying to get right with God, and wondering whether I had done that, and wondering how I would ever know for sure, and in my case, always doubting that I had done it, but usually going ahead as if I had. Here is a letter I had not seen until I began reading for this presentation, since it is not included in the Habit of Being, but is found in the Library of America volume. Letter to Carl Hartman. This is in 1954, it's 5 years before the letter to John Hawkes, and it's longer. Quoting Flannery here, Wise Blood is about a Protestant saint, written from the point of view of a Catholic, someone who believes there was a fall, has been a redemption, and will be a judgment. And I'm skipping around in this letter. This is what I imply that Hayes could not get away from, though in his terms, not mine. The book is about somebody whose insistence on what he would like to think is the truth leads him to what he most does not want. As I see Hayes, he most does not want to have been redeemed. He most wants to be shut of God, but Enoch, with his wise blood, unerringly lights on what man looks like without God and obligingly brings it for Hayes to have a look at. The redemption creates a debt that has to be paid. Parenthetically, she says, this is a fact to anybody who believes he has been redeemed by Christ. The redemption changes everything. Hayes does not come into his absolute integrity until he blinds himself. While he is preaching the church of Christ without Christ, he is going counter, actually, to his own wise blood. Hayes and Enoch both have wise blood, which is something that enables you to go in the right direction after what you want. Enoch's gets him inside an ape suit, and Hayes's gets him further and further inside himself, where one may be supposed to find the answer. I, as a Catholic, look on Hazel Moats as the only right kind of man, given in his circumstances. Hayes here asserts his wise blood in the ultimate way. When he says he does it to pay, he means to pay his part of the debt of redemption. And then I skip to the end to show how she sort of backs off. Here she becomes a bit more human here. You must excuse the tone of this letter, which so far sounds like a first epistle to the heathen. I am not really so sanctimonious as I sound. I just unfortunately have Hayes' vision and Enoch's disposition. In chapter 5 of Wise Blood, we find this. Enoch's brain was divided into two parts. The part in communication with his blood did the figuring, but it never said anything in words. The other part was stocked up with all kinds of words and phrases. Here's another letter I thought a lot about. It takes off in a slightly different direction. Letter to Thomas Mabry in 1955. She says, I was born and brought up a Catholic, and at some point I realized that not only was I a Catholic, but that this is all I was. That I was a Catholic, not like someone else would be a Baptist or a Methodist, but like someone else would be an atheist. I always found that an interesting thing to say. I feel like I am that someone else to whom she referred. Though the word atheist is far too easy. I am thought by some to be a Christian writer. I have twice been invited to speak at Fundamentalist Wheaton College after the publication of each of my novels. The interesting thing there is that they asked me back. In April, I will be giving an invited lecture to the theology department at Georgetown University, which is where O'Connor delivered her talk entitled The Catholic Novelist in the Protestant South, but I don't believe myself to be a Christian writer. And the title of my talk there will be Unwise Blood, and I continue with this. I don't know why they asked me. I mean, I really don't. I recently calculated that I'd heard maybe 1,400 sermons from the time I was 4 until the time I was 18. Sunday morning and evening, without fail. I grew up in Monroe, Georgia, in a Southern Baptist family. My father was chairman of the deacons, superintendent of the Sunday schools. He and my mother sang in the choir for 50 years, and my sister still does. My best memories of church are of the rare Sunday evenings in summer when there was no sermon. Only the piano and the singing of hymns. Flannery O'Connor says, the writer can choose what he writes about, but he cannot choose what he is able to make live. She says, the writer must be concerned with the texture of existence, all those concrete details of life that make actual the mystery of our position on earth. It seems that what I might be able to make live is a place where characters are brought up in the church, which they must deal with seriously. That is the texture of experience I know best. Those are the concrete details I can present, but my fiction is not devotional. It tries to be descriptive. It does not argue for or against. Though some characters may give their opinions and some events may lend themselves to considerations of what may be called mystery. If I were to follow my blood, then, would it necessarily be wise? Would it necessarily be unwise? One of her discarded titles was Wise Blood and Simple. Maybe my blood would be more simple than wise or unwise. Maybe Simple Blood should be the title of this talk. Maybe it should be called Confused Blood or Befuddled Blood. Since mystery is such a central concept in O'Connor's work, maybe we can allow the blood to be a mystery. And the word wise to be a mystery as well. I do not believe she used the word ironically. Whatever it should be called, for this presentation I reread Wise Blood, Mystery and Manners, The Habit of Being, and Brad Gooch's biography, Flannery. I also read Bruce Gentry's book, Flannery O'Connor's Religion of the Grotesque, Sarah Gordon's Flannery O'Connor, The Obedient Imagination, and Robert Cole's Flannery O'Connor's South. It was at some point in my rereading of the letters that I began to feel close to Flannery in a different way, a more personal way. It's true that I had known some of the people to whom letters were addressed, Louise Abbott, Bill Sessions, Ben Griffith, Alfred Korn, so that I already felt close in a superficial way. And having grown up only 60 miles from where Flannery grew up, lends itself to the same sort of feeling. But this was a sense of closeness of a different order. And it began after I watched a clip of the TV interview she did with Harvey Bright. And I heard Flannery's voice. I had heard it before, but not in maybe 35 years. Reading the letters this time, I began to hear her voice speaking the words, her actual voice. And I began to wish intensely that I'd had the chance Louise Abbott and Bill Sessions had had. I began to wish I'd been able to sit and talk with her at Andalusia. I grew up knowing a world like hers, knowing the people and the country she wrote about. My grandparents owned a small dairy farm, but they also had experienced the life of being tenant farmers. I grew up in a Protestant world. I would have wanted to discuss that with her. At the end of the letters, what I felt this time was loss and sorrow. Not only because the great writer was gone, but because Flannery was gone. Not only because the voice of the great writer was silent, but because Flannery, the young woman, had fallen silent. I know it is likely that if she had been able to observe me, I could have ended up in her work. I am so proud and vain and oblivious and limited. I am also a social scientist, a despised psychologist, a materialistic monist who denies the immaterial mind and its relation to the soul, a reader of existentialist philosophies, a shallow activist for civil rights after the fact, possessed of a certain self-righteousness nevertheless. Flannery would have seen right through me. It's likely she would have enjoyed herself. I do want to say, in defense of psychology, that it can be pursued without radical reductionism. No, we are not reduced to psychology, but it is a natural human activity. There are ways of seeing clearly within the discipline. No, it is not explanatory at the ultimate level, but there is no shame in it. But I was asked to comment on Wise Blood as a writer, not as a critic or an alternate universe young gentleman caller. One way to learn from Wise Blood is to study its 5 years of coming into being, its drafts and many revisions. One might study her correspondence, particularly with respect to Caroline Gordon Tate, as Bruce Gentry has done, looking at particular passages of imagery. But Wise Blood is, like all her work, instructive as language. Sentence to sentence, it is always a model of economy and clarity. The aspiring writer learns from her use of visual imagery, the drawing of character by appearance and action, thought and dialogue, her resilient humor, her managing of tonal complexity through point of view, her use of rhyming imagery and action. I come away from Wise Blood as I come away from all her work with favorite sentences. Here are a few. He was a white man with greased black hair and a greased black look to his suit. He moved like a crow, darting from table to table. And there's no continuity here. These are from the first of Wise Blood, but they're leaps. This is a famous sentence. Later he saw Jesus move from tree to tree in the back of his mind, a wild, ragged figure, motioning him to turn around and come off into the dark, where he was not sure of his footing, where he might be walking on water and not know it, and then suddenly know it and drown. This is one of my favorite. Mrs. Watts eyed him steadily with only a slight smirk. Then she put her other hand under his face and tickled it in his motherly way. "That's okay, son," she said. "Mama don't mind if you ain't a preacher." Hayes' shadow was now behind him and now before him and then broken up by other people's shadows. But when it was by itself, stretching behind him, it was a thin, nervous shadow walking backwards. Her mouth was open and her eyes glittered on him like two chips of green bottle glass. Enoch had on a yellowish white suit and a pinkish white shirt, and his tie was the color of green peas. He was smiling. He looked like a friendly hound dog with light mange. I may have to ask some questions here of the scholars. All the animal imagery in here is, I'm sure, has been written about, but it's just astonished me all over again. And this is Enoch Emery speaking. This is the welfare woman who took him in, or his daddy traded him to the welfare woman. She had a brick house, but it was Jesus all day long. He's speaking here to Hazel Moats. Enoch is. "Your jaw just crawls," he observed, watching the side of Hayes's face. "You don't never laugh. I wouldn't be surprised if you wasn't a real wealthy man." "I don't need Jesus," Hayes said. "What do I need with Jesus? I got Leora Watts." And this is speaking of his sexual experience with that woman. When he finished, he was like something washed ashore on her. And she had made obscene comments about him, which he remembered off and on during the day. His black hat set on his head with a careful, placed expression, and his face had a fragile look as if it might have been broken and stuck together again. Or like a gun no one knows is loaded. These are all from early pages of the novel. When I had the idea, well, let me read some sentences, and I started at the beginning, and there were so many, that I just have to stop. But I have to give you this one, and knowing a novel, you will know where this comes from. This is about Enoch Emery. He says, "To his mind, an opportunity to insult a successful ape came from the hand of Providence." The idea of a successful ape is just so delightful. I have to note it. I have to stop quoting. Wise Blood is rich with sentences that are striking for so many reasons. Flannery O'Connor is solid and transcendent, line by line. I believe that in the end, we are best served not by considering Wise Blood a text to be analyzed, like a frog in a bottle, she would say, and somehow definitively solved, a text to be given something like a correct reading. I believe we are best served, and she is best served, by our considering Wise Blood and all her stories to be vehicles for, as she said, concrete details of life that make actual the mystery of our position on earth. Her work must be experienced as mystery. I'd like to end my comments on Flannery O'Connor with two paragraphs about her from Robert Coles. "She is stalking pride. She grabbed it from everyday rural Georgia life and put it in story after story, collapsing Southern pride, the pride of landowners, of preachers, of dirt farmers, of mothers and sons and mothers and daughters and a grandfather and his grandson. Why not the pride of a counselor, a reformer, an agent of psychological change? As the dreary expression goes in what is called, speaking of ironies, the literature, her story is really one of pride and collision with pride and collision with pride. She knew her own kind of pride, and as a devout Catholic, she no doubt waged a lifelong prayerful struggle with herself, with her mind's self-importance, with a sinful yearning pride that goes back historically, or some would say mythologically, to the Garden of Eden." And this is the second paragraph. "Her God was the God who entered history, lived the life, came to know sin, God become man, the Word become flesh, the incarnation. She knew the heresies her neighbors more than flirted with. She saw the theatrical side to their emotionally intense God-possessed days and nights. She saw in Baldwin County, every week, a series of miracle and morality plays, a parade of spectacles, sometimes part of, literally, a road company, the itinerant minister and his tragicomic presentations. Though she was a sophisticated, highly educated, and thoroughly rational person, she never succumbed to the arrogance that would have had her turn the South's old-time religion into a big joke for them up there, the northern cognoscenti, or nearer at hand, those belonging to the South's secular salons. She manifestly cared for her neighbors, was even awed by their fervent, searching journey toward it." And I just have to say again, I was, as I got into it, I was really thankful for this. When you're forced to study, you're glad for it. And I was glad for it. Robert Cole's book, and he was speaking about her disdain for psychologists and so forth. Of course, he was a psychiatrist. I don't know if he's still with us. He was a psychiatrist and not from around here, as we say. And so his perspective on it was really very interesting to me, his perspective on her and on her work. Now, I want to read, not a long time, but I want to read from my first novel, The Sweet Everlasting, which will be the best thing that I've ever written. I don't feel I'll ever get back to it. And that, as I continue to speak lordly of my own work, let me say that the reason for that is not because it's so wonderful, but because for me, when I go back to look at it, I realize what empowered me to write it. And that was that I realized I had to write it in dialect. I had to write it in the voice of a country band. I had, for a while, a section in that voice, and then I had an omniscient narrator. I threw away a lot of pages of omniscient narration because it wasn't omniscient and it wasn't good. It was dull. We might talk at length about the narrator in Flannery O'Connor did. That narrator, that fierce narrator, one of the most extraordinary things that anybody has ever written. And I went back to look at her work. I don't know if she ever wrote anything in the first person. I don't think she ever published anything in the first person, but I can't imagine her writing in the first person because she was so much larger than that. I'm not. In fact, I can really only write fiction in the first person. And when I realized this had to be an old country man first person voice, then I was able to write it and not worry about the language, except that it had to be true to the dialect. It had to be true to the dialect, and I have the ear for that. The ear, which she says is the Southerner's main tool. Southern writer's main tool is that ear, which she had. So I'll read a little bit of this. I'll read the beginning of The Sweet Everlasting, which will sort of orient you, and then I'll read a few more pages. It was an idea as real as a sharp stick, and even better for drawing blood, but if you looked at it good like I finally did, it didn't have nothing to back it up. Out of a 6-year and 2-month sentence to the state prison at Milledgeville, I served it all, August 1954 to October 1960. I was crazy wild, then I wasn't, then I was. That's how it went. One second I'd be a free man with Susan beside me and the boy on my lap, and the next I'd be awake on my back and looking up into the dirty light coming through my cell window. The day they let me out, I walked on down the road and sat under a tree. And I remember how, when the wind picked up, leaves started to fall. I'm 74 years old now. That was a long time ago, like it was another life. But some of what happened before that morning, every now and then, it seemed like yesterday. That's the first chapter, less than a page. Every time I stand up to read fiction from a novel, I want to read the whole novel. You know, but I hope you'll read the novel. It's hard to jump, and it's hard to explain, but Ellis Burke has been in prison, and we find out he's in prison on the first page, but we don't find out why till near the end of the book. But I want to read this scene about his being in prison, and part of the reason I want to read it is because it establishes the practice of reading the Bible that he adopted in prison. And this is part of that texture of experience that I was talking about. After I'd served half my time at the state prison, they put me out walking on a road crew, cutting weeds along the shoulder of the highway. They'd give us each a sling blade, and they'd put a guard with a shotgun out there, and we'd work from right after sun up to nearly sundown. Most of the time I'd been locked up, I'd had me a job working in the kitchen. Now, I pretty much got used to that, but then when some knives turned up missing, they cleared out everybody and put us on other jobs. I didn't think it would make much difference to me one way or the other, but it did. Going out every day and coming back in, I mean, your whole world is made up of what's inside and what's outside. That's the way you see everything. You got no choice. As long as you stay in, you kind of get set. But then when you go out into the free world, it mixes things up. You're out, but not really. And then when they open the gates and the bus rolls you back in, it turns you inside out. One day the bus took us a good ways down south of Milledgeville and put us cutting weeds on a stretch of highway that curved around Red Oak. To get there, we had to pass through the middle of town, and it just ate me up inside. We passed right by the mill village, and I seen where our house used to be, where me and Susan and W.D. used to live, and we drove past the school where W.D. went to. They put us to cutting weeds right down below where the dirt road that cuts through Cozy Town comes out on the highway. Every car that come by us while we worked, I wanted to look at the people. And at the same time, I didn't want to look. I wanted to see a face I recognized from the mill, but then a part of me hoped I wouldn't. As far as I know now, I never did. There's something about the air of a place you start to recognize if you live there long enough. The way it smells and feels will be different from anywhere else. You might not be able to say exactly what it is. Maybe the trees or the weeds or the dirt or the breeze coming up from the creek. But it'll be all that or something like it and a lot more, and you'll breathe it in and you'll believe there ain't no place else on earth that smells exactly that way. And it's right then that your heart might break. Even if you're just an ordinary person walking down the road, but if you've been throwing your life away for nothing, for an idea that when you try to look at it, there ain't nothing there. And then if somebody's got a shotgun held on you, ready to hand you off and put you back behind bars, you can imagine what the smell of home will do to you. How it'll make you want to turn and run and keep going, so maybe you'll take your last breath and you'll take it right there. They held me for a year over at the state hospital. Then they sent me to the regular prison. I didn't care where I was at. At the hospital, they give you medicines that make you feel bad, and they give you them shocks. They give you all kinds of tests, asking questions that didn't make no sense. Finally, they got tired of fooling with me. They shipped me out to the regular prison. Like I said, I worked in the kitchen and out on the road crew, except they'd always be having you do other things. Sometimes something would need painting or cleaning, we dug ditches and unloaded trucks. They might have had some construction they wanted you to work on, and I hauled a lot of block. The harder the work, the better I liked it. The tireder I was, the less I had to think. I didn't want to think. I never took none of the books or magazines they'd bring around, since sometimes one of the pictures would remind me of Susan, and I couldn't stand to look at it. I did read the Bible, though. Not because I believed it exactly, but because I already knew what was in it. At least I thought I did. Preacher come around giving away these little Gideons that only held Psalms in the New Testament, and I took one and I carried it with me till it fell apart and I got me another one. I carried it in my pocket. And when I'd be working somewhere and we'd get a break, I'd light up a cigarette and pull out my Gideon. And so folks got the idea I was big on religion. They didn't know I used it to keep from thinking. It did work for me at first, and even later on sometimes, but finally it didn't. By that time, I was in the habit of trying to use it that way, and I couldn't quit. I got me another book from the prison library that helped me pass the time, too. And when I was in my cell, I started to use that one. It was a book that give every word in the Bible in alphabetical order. And then it give the book and the chapter and verse and where you could find it. It had everything in it. And I'm talking about every A and every D that's in there. It had them and where they were at. I got me a notebook and I copied out lists of words where you could find them. Then I turned to the Gideon and maybe I'd copy out the verse. I got me a full Bible to use when I was in the cell so I could look up words from the Old Testament. I just flipped the book open and see what I come up with. I know there's folks think you can get a special message by doing that with a Bible, but I'm not one of them. Wasn't looking for no message in the first place, but it's true enough though that when I flipped through the book, some of the words I seen there made me want to stop and look them up, while most of them didn't. And lots of times, I couldn't have told you why there was a difference. I looked up window and promise and hill and salt. I looked up names I found there, Ezra and Isaiah and Susanna. I looked up empty. I looked up what the Bible has to say about animals, goats and swine and birds and cattle. I've seen how in the Psalms it says not to be like the mute, which has no understanding, it says. I looked up fire and yesterday and woman and rain. I looked up flower. I looked up work and I've seen in Isaiah where it says that the Lord will rise up angry to do his work, his strange work. I'm going to read something I've never read. I mean, I've read it, but because I read everything I write aloud over and over and over and over and over again. Of course, anybody who's a writer, you know your family just thinks you're absolutely insane. He's in there talking to himself again. This is from the novel that I've been working on for 4 years now, and probably have that many more years to go before I finish it, and it will be a short book. Just so much of it is going to have to be thrown away. Well, that's the way Flannery was. You know, she took her 5 years to write Wise Blood. It took her 7 years, I think. The Violent Bear It Away. Or as somebody came into a bookstore and asked, the bookstore clerk said, "We don't have Wise Blood, but we've got that other book, The Bear That Ran Away With It." So that was priceless. I have to say before I stop, my favorite thing of hers is those letters. The letters, I think, are her great work. And I know that's sort of a blasphemy, but I really think that if you read the letters, well, maybe Mystery and Manners, I think both of those are documents that any writer has to treasure. The title of this novel for now is called The Serpent's Joke. It's called The Serpent's Joke, and it comes from epigraph is from Robert Penn Warren. His truth is a poem entitled Truth. Truth is what you cannot tell. Truth is a trick that history over and over again plays on us. Truth is a serpent's joke. And the other epigraph is from W.B. Du Bois. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others. Now, I don't know how much of this I can read, but it very closely parallels my life, and I have had such a difficult task of making this fiction. It is fiction. It begins September 1974, which is when I went to teach at Fort Valley State College, a historically black institution. So I'm tying it exactly to that, but it's not me. People from the small town had brought suit against the college in federal court, demanding it desegregate, a bitter irony for many, and now a consent decree called for the hiring of more white faculty. I thought I would be there no more than a year or two. Faculty housing was taken, they'd hired me late, and everywhere else was filled by students. So I found a mobile home for rent, a single wide Shelby, furnished and air conditioned. I had lived in a trailer park before, and I was comfortable there. The young woman, one space over, said she heard I taught at the Nigger College, and she asked me if that was true. I said, yes, it was. She said, what's that like? I said, well, it's all right. Shoot, I'd be scared. You're not scared? Not really. I told her she wouldn't be scared either if she just went out there and saw what it was like. I could have said, if I were you, though, I wouldn't go out there and call it the Nigger College. But it was easier not to have that conversation, and easy was okay with me. When I came to campus for my interview, I met with a search committee chaired by Dr. W.L.B. Reed, a historian who was around 60 years old. I'm skipping through here. The other committee members were Arlene Jackson and Dr. Clarence Plant, sometimes called Billy D. or Dr. Billy, a twin, because of his uncanny resemblance to Billy D. Williams. Dr. Plant would become my supervisor in the psychology department. The committee had interviewed two other candidates the same day, but they had chosen me, they said. They told me where my office would be. They spent the last half hour giving me advice about how to settle in. They touched on personal matters that were outside the scope of what was proper in a job interview. I was not aware of the impropriety at the time, but they were, and they made that clear. Dr. Reed told me that the formal interview had ended, and since they'd already decided the job was mine, they wanted to go ahead and deal with some other matters. Arlene Jackson asked me about my family. I said I'd been raised by my grandparents. My grandfather was a loom fixer in a cotton mill. They were poor people who couldn't help out with college, so I'd had to borrow a lot of money over the years. I told them I really needed the job. "Well, son," Dr. Reed said, "we just told you you had the job. So let's talk about some other matters. Dr. Plant wanted to know if I thought my youth might be a factor in my working at the college. Then asked me the same question about my race. I said I was sure neither would be a problem. I told them I didn't really think of myself as young. They found this amusing. I was 26. And I offered a wise thought or two about race, which they accepted without comment or change of expression. I want to skip down a little. When the interview was over, Dr. Plant took me to a place called Miss Mary's. Later that afternoon, we went out to Arlene Jackson's house, where she and Claude, her husband, held a small gathering on most Friday afternoons. People showed up around 4 to have a drink, but rarely did anyone drink a lot. The Jacksons discouraged that. They were not against taking a drink. Once or twice I saw them both seriously inebriated, but they were determined to enjoy those Fridays in their own way. And what they wanted was an occasion in their home for people to share a drink if they liked and to talk at ease about their ideas and their work. What they studied or created or discovered or read or observed, their real work, Arlene. There was to be no gossip, no campus politics, no complaining about the students or administrators, nothing from what was called the street committee. These were excluded, along with sports talk as the usual and most natural topic. But the rules were always broken. At the Jacksons that afternoon with Dr. Reed and his wife Mabel, secretary of the college president, Dr. Curtis Oliver from the music department, Camille Williams, a striking young woman who worked in the library and was said to be the poet in residence, Artis Boone from political science, and Nabil Ziad, a Palestinian who was Arlene's colleague in the art department. We all went into the large, oddly shaped sunroom of the house Claude had built, a locally famous structure. The tile floor slanted a little. There were doors of different sizes. He called it outsider architecture. People helped themselves at the bar, though Arlene served me my drink. They asked how the interview went. Dr. Plant said it did go well. Mr. Moon here seems to be a good fit for us in several ways. He'll get that dissertation finished this year. We'll be all set. Wonderful, she said. Dr. Ziad said, "The dissertation is not done." His Arabic-inflected English was delivered with a rasping voice, a result of damage to his throat. "It is hard to finish such a project while teaching. Am I wrong to say this?" "No, Ziad, you're right. You are," Dr. Reed said. "But we think this young man will follow through. We have every confidence that he will." "He's already made good progress," Dr. Plant said. "The research is done. He just has to write it up. Is that fair to say?" "Yes, sir," I said. "Absolutely." I told them I had gathered all the data. That was not true. I had gathered none. And that I still needed to run some statistical analyses, and then I'd start writing. Dr. Ziad said, "So you've not written any of it?" He shook his head. "There are many unfortunate stories I could tell you, many of them. You must be very disciplined to do what you're trying to do, very disciplined." "Yes, sir," I said. "I know you're right." Camille Williams asked what my dissertation was about, and I told her. Dr. Plant talked about his upcoming lecture series. He'd be bringing in a Dr. Akbar, one of the main figures in the Association of Black Psychologists. Did I know Dr. Akbar's work? I did not. Arlene asked Dr. Reed how his book was coming. He said he was having a hard time getting access to some records. Otherwise, he was making good progress, but it's hard to get an angle on it that feels right. You know what I mean? I asked him the title of his book. "For now, it's called Strange Peach." "Ah," I said, as if the title meant something to me. And I heard how foolish I sounded, but I did think he'd go on and say what the book was about. And then there's some discussion where they get off talking about the football team, and Arlene gets angry. And my character's a tall character, and so he talks about playing basketball. He's going to play basketball on the intramural team. Dr. Oliver left, and after one more drink, Camille Williams said she needed to be going too. And when she stood, so did Artis Boone. And when they had gone, Claude Jackson said to nobody in particular, "I told Boone he better leave that alone." "Old Boone can't help himself," Arlene said. "He's just weak." "Listen, Camille may be lonely these days, but she's not that lonely. She can do a lot better than Boone, and she knows it. Even his wife knows that." Dr. Reed took my glass and went to the bar, poured us both another scotch. "Now, Mr. Moon," he said, "there's one bit of business that I didn't want to bring up in the interview. I'm sure it won't be a problem, but we do need to talk about it in case it does become an issue. He handed me the scotch. You see, he said, in the box where it asks for your race, you check Caucasian. You swear that you are a white man. And I'm sure you are. I'm sure you're telling the truth. Why wouldn't you? I think we'd all agree on that, but listen, do you have any way to prove it? Sir? Prove that you're white. Do you have any paperwork that will prove you're white? We're under this court order, you know, so we don't want to claim in front of the court that we have hired a white man if it's not true. So do you have that? Just in case they ask us, we know you're white. Dr. Plant said, no doubt in my mind. Well, I said my birth certificate, I guess. Birth certificate, okay, Dr. Reed said. That's a start, that's good. Birth certificate's good. What else you got? I don't really know, I said. I'm just white. And apparently that was very funny. Arlene said, yes, you are, baby. She patted me on the knee, and don't you worry about it, it's all right. Nabil Ziad laughed along with the others, but said, you Negars stick together. Do you know that? Claude said, come on, Ziad, what the hell's a Negar? And they all turned toward me as if expecting an answer. And I did not know what was happening. I had to learn my place, and I had to remember it. I was junior faculty. I was young. I knew nothing about the college or its history. First time I heard somebody use the acronym HBCU, I asked what it stood for, and the way people looked at me made it clear I needed to keep quiet and pay attention and learn some things if I wanted to survive. I needed to quit talking so much, and I needed to listen more closely. Dr. Wilma Carruthers leaned over to me and said about the new vice president who was presiding over the faculty meeting that we were in this scene. She says, that Negro is as black as a gorilla out of the Congo. And she laughed, turned, and said the same to Dr. George Mabosso on the other side of her, who said, he has no better judgment than that either. No, he does not. They had been both opposed to the hiring of the new vice president, the former dean at Fort Valley State, another historically black institution nearly 2 hours northwest of us. Dr. Carruthers from nearby Waycross, Georgia, was of light complexion. Dr. Mabosa was a Nigerian, darker than the new vice president. He had been her student 20 years ago, I was told. People said she'd helped him attend graduate school and had even paid for some of it. They were like mother and son, and they disdained the new vice president's occasional lapses into regionalisms, a subject-verb disagreement or non-standard pronunciation. Dr. Carruthers had worked hard to speak an English indistinguishable from that of someone broadcasting the news on network television. Dr. Mabosso spoke a version of the King's English. And I spoke, as I still do, with the inflections of a white man brought up in the rural South with vowels that tell people where I'm from. Dr. Carruthers told me not to pronounce the word on like the word on. She said, you lay something on the table, not on the table. But she had worked so hard to change her way of speaking that she had overcorrected and now couldn't bring herself to use that long O even when it was called for. She'd say, I own the house, not I own the house. Dr. Carruthers enjoyed herself when she was around me. She would stop by my office and say, Moon, who dressed you this morning? She'd say, Moon, look at all this mess. Has no one taught you how to operate the trash can? Once she called me into her office and asked me to pronounce the words ink pen because she needed a lift. She waved me over to sit with her during meetings. But when she likened the new vice president to a gorilla, I didn't know how to hold my face. I didn't know why I was hearing that. I'll stop there.
We have some time for some Q&A, and then we have refreshments, and we can continue the conversation there if you'd like.
You know, I waited over whether or not to use that word as I was reading, the charged word that I read that I won't repeat, but I figured I don't use it any other time, but when you're reading fiction and you've got people who are using the word in fiction, I think you have to use it. But it's unpleasant. So.
Jensen, invariably probably invited to Fort Valley to read from that book if you publish it. Did you skip that chapter?
Oh no, that's a complimentary chapter. You mean the one I just, the last part?
Well, the
with the N-word?
We use the word, yeah.
No, I won't read it there.
Yeah.
When I went there, and really this is fiction, but to talk about that, which I'm sure I'll have to write, if this gets published, I'll have to write the essay that says, you know, what's the truth? There's nobody recognizable in here. Very minor characters might be recognizable. Events might be recognizable, but it's fiction. And the character is not me. I've had to build a character who's not me. But when I was teaching there, when I first went there, things were looser in the early 70s in all sorts of ways, and also in the use of language. If that word came up to be said in class when talking about anything, you know, if somebody had said that, I would say it. But about the last 15 years I was there, when we'd be talking about language and we'd be talking about racist language in class, I got to the point where I can't say the word. I don't want you, as my students, to have had the experience of hearing it come out of my mouth, because then you can't unhear that. And it's different for us. It's a different thing. So I didn't really plan to read it when I came here, but it's in the fiction and needs to be said, I think, there. But I generally avoid, it's all through The Sweet Everlasting, because that's a book about vicious racism. And you can't have your characters who are speaking, talking about African Americans. You know, it just won't work. That's very hurt. Yes.
I'm a Catholic, and I just wonder, I have friends who think that we need to be saved from the Pope because we're Catholic. And I wonder, did Flannery O'Connor feel any of that animosity, or how did she react to that? What's her life like?
I'm sure she did. Others would know better than I about that. Being a Catholic in now, but even particularly in the Old South, must have been pretty rough. Mm. You know, that's part of the, on the list of the Klan, you know.
Just to interject for historical context, during the presidential race in 1960, we kept hearing a Catholic being elected as president,
oh, yeah,
folks going to run the country.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have
that
discussion today. But that seemed to be prevalent and quite common here in the South in the 1960s.
Yes, that's true. But as far as what Flannery experienced, somebody will know, but I don't know the answer to that. My feeling about that, and I addressed this in The Sweet Everlasting, have one of my characters who, in one of the time periods I address, when he's an old man, he moves back to Monroe, and he lives with a man who's from Detroit, who's a Catholic, who used to work in the auto industry. And they live together, and they discuss Protestant and Catholic. It parallels some of the discussions I've had with my friends who are Catholic, writers who are Catholic. And I find it to be a fundamentally different way of viewing the world in terms of the Christian world. That is, the communion, when we had it, was soda crackers and grape juice. And After the communion, my brother and I used to go around and eat the extra soda cracker, eat the extra saltines, and buy an extra grape juice. And when I discussed that with my Catholic friends, they were just appalled. Well, of course, it wasn't the body of Christ. It wasn't the blood of Christ. My character in The Sweet Everlasting asks his Catholic friend, when he drinks the wine, and it's literally the blood of Christ, and he says, "Well, does it taste like blood?" And his friend says, "What kind of question is that?" Which is the question that a former priest asked me when I asked him the same question when I was doing research for the book. So she must have felt, I think she, as Robert Cole says, she had respect for what her fellow members of the community were trying to do in all their strange ways. We're trying to find Christ. We're trying to get right with God. And she had a way of getting right. There's nothing we can do as Protestants except make it happen, get it right. And so there's an advantage in that, but I can't do more than speak in a relatively shallow way about that. Her biography, I don't know how well it's regarded, the Brad Gooch biography, but I enjoyed it, and I don't know how thorough it is. I think, is Bill Sessions still working on one, or do we know?
He wishes he were.
Oh, okay. Well, that must mean something. But I found her life just fascinating. And the fact that she, you know, she goes to Iowa, and she comes out of here, and she goes to Iowa. She goes right into Iowa, not in the writer's school, and studying English first, and then, of course, goes into the writer's school, and is immediately acclaimed as a genius writer. Andrew Lytle and others. And she becomes friends. She goes to Yaddo. She's friends with Robert Lowell and corresponded with Elizabeth Bishop and friends with Elizabeth Hardwick and so many others who recognize her right away. And I don't want to belabor this. I know we probably want to end it, but let me just go back to what I said about sentence by sentence. She is an astonishing writer, sentence by sentence and image by image. If you look at the face imagery, if you look at the eye imagery, if you look at the animal similes and others, if you read the book and then you reread it and then reread it, you will see that it rhymes all through, that this image calls to this image, this action calls to this action. This usage of light calls to this usage of light. This use of blood calls to this use of blood. And all throughout it is hilariously funny and heartbreaking and accurate. You don't find a false note. I evaluate this as a southern speaker. I didn't find a false note anywhere in it in terms of the speech. And I never cease to be increasingly impressed when I read her. I think my favorite piece of her writing in fiction is The Displaced Person. And I have my own reasons for loving that story. But everybody has a favorite, I guess.
What's your opinion of the John Huston's movie?
You know, I don't think you can make a movie of The Last Blood. It's been a long time since I saw it. What do you think about it?
I didn't read the book, so.
Yeah. Well, if you read the book and see the movie, I don't know. It just seemed to me, movies of most books that are any good are not equal to the book. Because there's so much that's internal in the book, and if the book is any good, it's about language. It's about the language. I mean, come on. Somebody's about to make a movie of Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. That can't happen. You cannot make, aside from all the blood, which might make it sell, but you cannot find that language on the screen. It cannot be spoken. The richness of it is beyond the cinema. That's unfortunate because the film is the dominant narrative mode of our time and will be. The Sweet Everlasting was almost made into a movie, and I was really unhappy when it didn't happen because I wanted to get me a big hat or something and strut around Hollywood. But now maybe I'm rationalizing, but I just sort of like it to be for the book to be the dominant. To be the main story and not for some 90-minute treatment.
Theoretically, though, shouldn't both movies and writing rely on imagery? Shouldn't there be some synergy between the two?
There should be, but the...
Seems like. I didn't like the movie either, by the way.
Yeah, the direct, but in the movies, the director is the story. The director's the same, yeah.
I think what you have to understand is that there's a very different imagery that's conveyed by words and that's conveyed by visuals. In other words, the words on the page are not the same as the visual that you see with your eyes. And it's two different experiences. Now, I think that you can have a really good book and a really good movie. They just won't be the same thing. They'll be very different pieces of work.
I wrote a screenplay for this book, mm-hmm. if anybody wants to buy the screenplay, and make the movie.
How much?
A lot of money. A lot of money. But I wrote the screenplay because I worked on the screenplay for the other book with the guy who wrote it. Who sold it, and then the company went bankrupt. So it was almost made. But when I wrote the screenplay for this, I just did it to see if I could do it. And I got the final draft software, and I did it, and I thought it was a good screenplay. But by the time I got to the end of it, I was so sick of the form, because it's not writing. The only place you can get your language involved is in the dialogue. That's the only place, and they don't want it anywhere else. And that somewhere else is where so much of the novel exists, where you're drawing the scene, setting the scene, and so I don't want to be a screenwriter. Don't think I'm in trouble, in any danger.
Yeah, I just had a question about artistic practice, and certainly films are, it's not really just the director, it's the screenwriter, it's the cinematographer, it's the actors. I mean, there's an ensemble that's creating it. But for a writer, it's just the writer. So Flannery was famous for having a very, sort of regular schedule of writing. What's your practice? I'm curious about how artists work and what their daily practice might be.
Well, I always lie and say that I write every day, 2 hours in the morning, like Flannery. I try to do that when I sit down to write. I used to write before I went to work because I had to go teach every day, and I would get up at 4:30 or 5 and write for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then go to work, and I didn't have to deal with it the rest of the day. And I got a lot of work done. Poems, I was writing poems that way. Now that I'm retired, I can get up anytime I want to, and so I have to force myself to go to the desk. But when I do go to the desk, I set a timer for 2 hours, and I try to get correspondence out of the way other things out of the way. I've had to move out of my main office, which has so much stuff in it, into a little basement cubbyhole where there's nothing, so I cannot be distracted. Where there's no TV, there's no guitar, there's no kitchen, there's nothing to take me away from it. And I have to force myself to do it. I have to sit there for 2 hours. That's the best way I know to do it. And if you get into it, the 2 hours, you're surprised when the 2 hours is up. If the writing, though, if the writing doesn't engage you as you're doing it, something is wrong. And so it's a chore to start off with. But once you get into it, it is a place to lose yourself. And I think, for the most part, in all kinds of writing, to forget about yourself. You don't want yourself too much on the page. And I don't think we saw Flannery on the page in a way that, even with that fierce narrative, we couldn't help but think about her humor. I mean, who could say that? Who could come up with that? But she I just looked at that interview with Harvey Bright again. Has everybody seen that? Have y'all seen that?
It's a bonus on the DVD for Wise Blood, and I believe it's on YouTube also.
Well, that's such an interesting interview, and she's so, he'd ask her a question, she'd say yes. Several times she said yes. Why'd you write your novel? Well, I thought I ought to write a novel, so I got to work and wrote one, she said. And he's fumbling with his papers and had the obligatory cigarette going. Why you had to have a cigarette, I don't know. In the mid-50s on TV, but you did. But her voice to me, as I said in my comments, when I heard that voice, and I don't know that there's anything distinctive about the voice, but I couldn't keep from hearing it as I read the letters. And when she was so, I mean, her letters to people with whom she disagreed, the letters to Mariette Lee are some of my favorite letters, where she's giving her a hard time. I don't know how I got in there.
Perhaps we should adjourn, and there's some sweets.
Thank you.
Hi, y'all.
Is there a restroom?
There is. Yes.
Myself, Janet Kellhoff.